I think I'm going to ask that we pass on to Brian Collins now, because we will have time at the end for more discussion. Brian's going to talk about identity management, which is really at the core of everything that James has been talking about. So,
pass the water along.
When you have your water.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. As Robin just said, the concept of identity turned out to be one of the very important concepts that we examined in the Cyber Trust and Crime Prevention Foresight Study. So what I'm going to touch on here is a subset of the whole issue of identity, that is the management of the security of identity information. Security of information management is a bigger set of activities, so identity information has some peculiar properties which are worth addressing, partly because they're very topical, but partly because they contribute significantly to the trustworthiness of complex environments which people are trying to put together. So the other sort of health warning is I'm going to touch on things which are to do with the National ID Card Program. That's not to say that's not the only example of an identity management process that needs to be looked at. Anyone working in a large commercial organization has an identity management process to do with their employees or their contractors or their relationships with suppliers or with lots of other things, actually, but you don't generally think about it as identity management. So I don't want you to be totally hung up on the National ID Card Program, which is very, very topical, but some of the examples I touch on will be drawn from that as an example. But I want you to try and think, if you will, on a broader front, and I'll try and give some examples where a broader context is relevant. So, agenda, really, headline issues, and I'm not going to go through all of these, I'm going to touch on some of them. Firstly, why do you have ID management and why do you want ID security? It may sound self-evident, but I'll come expand on that in a moment. Then there's some practical process and technology issues, which by now you'll have read, and you can see that some of those are very pertinent to the national program. Some of them are slightly more subtle, and some of them James has just touched on to do with social issues. Excuse the spelling mistake. There's aspects of technological solutions, Martin likes that word, I can see why I smile, which are to do with what sort of technology can you use, not only for identity management but for the security processes that go around it, because they are mutually interactive. I won't say much about program management tonight. This is actually an extraction from a much longer talk on the subject, but program management for an activity as complex as this is quite significant and it's quite difficult. So, what's the purpose of having an identity management process? Reliable and secure proof of identity. I'll come back to what those words mean as we go through. So in the context of the National ID Card Program, but actually in general, it allows citizens to prove their identity to someone who needs that proof. Proof is a very strong word. Is it proof to an acceptable level of risk? To an acceptable level, not actually understanding what the risks are? Who's carrying the risk? Questions like that come out. And there's an assumption in that phrase that you have one identity. Now, you only have one body, but you may want to have more than one identity in a social fabric. And indeed, some people I've worked with say it's actually part of our right to have control over more than one identity. We want to be able to be called more than one thing, to have credentials that make up our identity managed by us in different mixes according to the circumstance. And when I say those words, you'll probably all identify with circumstances where that is true for you. I've just been working today with a colleague who chooses to have a different mother's maiden name every time he's challenged. That gives him control over that piece of verification information, because it's the one that's most commonly used. And a byproduct of that is, if that identity information was ever stolen, he knew where it was stolen from, because he knew which bogus maiden name he gave to which organisation, if he can remember it.
Yes.
But that's him controlling his own credentials and, in some sense, his multiple identity. I'm sure we could talk half the night about that, but let's move on. Now, it is alleged that if you've got reliable and secure proof of identity, then you can at least make it harder for terrorists and criminal activity to be pursued. And there certainly is some evidence that a lot of crimes are perpetrated on the back of having multiple or false identities. Now, whether or not an ID management service reduces that, there is much less evidence for. It is also asserted that it would prevent illegal immigration and illegal working. Again, you can see why that might be perceived to be the case, but there is relatively little evidence to date that that is the case. There is more evidence for is that a proper identity management system deters illegal access to services and payments. In other words, those not entitled to those services and payments. Now, that's different from proving identity, it's proving rights. And it's a very subtle but very important distinction. The difference between asserting that you have rights and giving sufficient information to validate those rights and asserting identity and giving sufficient information to validate that identity. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Then further on, we manage business transactions. We facilitate business transactions, particularly high-value business transactions, where identity of rights to value that is perhaps stored in a bank account or creditworthiness, where you need more than just a token, which is what we tend to use at the moment. Now, of course, the big financial institutions are becoming more and more interested in strengthening the ways in which they manage high-value transactions for all sorts of reasons. And then there's an etc., because there's lots of other things that people have asserted an identity management service could support. And it would add value to or prevent crime, criminal activity with respect to. And again, that list goes on for quite some time. So, as I hope has become clear, it's quite important to elaborate very clearly what the purpose is of an identity management service, because they all have different attributes and different features. And if you don't do that, you'll either end up building something which doesn't meet the goals very specifically and with a high level of integrity and acceptability, or you don't make anything that works. Or worse, you make something that doesn't work. Now, I want to pick on some of the elements of what goes to make up the identity management service, and it's pretty obvious that enrolling the identity information into the service management system is a very important part of it. Secure enrolment, secure storage of enrolment data is absolutely crucial. And we all go through that at the moment in various ways to get the documents that we currently carry. Excuse me, whether that's a driving license or a passport or a credit card or something else. Most of them, if not all of them, are derived from your birth certificate. It is the single point of failure. It's also probably one of the most thievable and forgeable documents that you carry around. But that said, that's the document we use as the root of everything and everything else that flows from it. So the whole issue of enrolment data and the validity of that enrolment data is an absolutely essential part of the enrolment process. So not only do those documents and the credentials that they provide have to be secure, the processes have to be secure as well. So what documents are used? How can staff tell whether they're genuine? Can you then check them? Some of us have been through fairly high-level defence and other security clearances in this country, and we know how rigorous that process is. It's also extremely expensive, and you need very well-trained people to do it. So what checking is done on your credentials when you go into somewhere to get a passport? At the moment, you can get a passport in this country without actually ever turning up. The first time. Think about the consequences. If there are inconsistencies in that set of credentials, that biographical footprint, if you like, how are those inconsistencies resolved? As an example, for about the 41st time, I'm going through a security check for a piece of work I'm doing in Parliament. My parents were first cousins. And you will probably immediately have worked out that meant my mother's maiden name is the same as her married name. And for the first time in 41 checks on my background, someone has queried it. Most of the other times, they bothered to go and look in the records and discovered that what I was asserting was true. But this time they didn't bother to check, they asked me, which isn't the right way to do it. Are you sure it's the same? Yeah. Well, of course I'm going to say that if that's what I wrote on the form. So, inconsistencies, that wasn't an inconsistency, but it was a quirk. So how long is this process going to take? Because, again, in the national scheme, if you've got 55 million people, and it takes, as it does for a really rigorous defence level check, 3 months, everyone can do the arithmetic, it's out of sight. And in addition, do you trust the people who are doing the enrolment? And why should you? So there's a whole issue of technical document information management and personnel management processes that go to make up the security process. And that infrastructure itself has to be looked after. Because some of it is IT-based, some of it's paper-based, and it really does, if you want to defraud the ID management process, there's a glorious place to do it, because it's right at the beginning. Because the verification process, which has a wide range of usage scenarios, and there's some which more apply to the national scheme than to a commercial scheme, is particularly important. But if I tell you at that verification process all that information is transferred to you, and you aren't who I think you are, in that verification, does the word phishing come to mind, then you've already got quite a lot of my identity information at the point of verification. And if you aren't who you say you are, plus or minus the biometrics, you can then go away and use that information for nefarious purposes. That's exactly what phishing is. So it's the subsequent use of verified information. Hence my colleague who uses a different mother's maiden name has sewn a trap for someone who fishes on that information. Just dwell briefly on some of the technology solutions. Can't spell it or say it. Firstly, we have, at least in the national program, the concept of a ID card scheme. Well, card technology, you know, is relatively new, actually, in the whole history of technologies, and is already beginning to change. We're carrying around lots of much smarter, much more capable tokens than a piece of plastic card. Anyone in IT is now walking around with best part of a gigabyte storage on a memory stick, which is hung around their neck or in their pocket. And he said, digging out his mobile phone, what's in there by way of a storage, processing, very high grade encryption and authentication processes is hugely powerful. And you get given one of those when you take out a contract. You don't have to pay for it. And it's online most of the time. This is off now, but there you go. So, a memory device, cheaper, widely available, wide range of formats, internationally interoperable, and Motorola will sell you one with a fingerprint reader on the back. So it won't work unless your finger's on it once it's trained. So why have we got cards? The point I'm trying to make is that we should be very careful about committing ourselves into programs which use one technology for an ID management service, because the technology that is most suitable may be different for different circumstances, and they perhaps all need to interoperate. Some of them are based on proximity reading. You don't have to have contact. There's advantages and disadvantages to that. We could go into that at great detail. In fact, Martin could do it much better than I could. But if you're going to pass data over a network, then you also need to be sure that the network looks after it. When you put your card in to get money at an ATM in the high street or in the railway station, you assume that all the information that goes backwards and forwards between that reader and the bank is secure. And if you thought it wasn't, you probably wouldn't be happy about taking money out of the wall. I can assure you it is as secure as we know how to make it. But that same thing is going to apply for your personal data, if not more so, because money is replaceable, but your identity isn't. You've only got one shot at losing it. Once you've lost it and someone else has defrauded you, then a lot of other people can do the same thing. You can't really sort of say, issue me another one. It's not so easy to do that. And that means the integrity of all the system's implementation and its operation are really good, really vital for good user experience. And again, in the national program, they're going to get one bite at getting this right in terms of user experience. If that first bite isn't right, and user experience of the first usage of it doesn't feel right, you can imagine what the backwash is going to be, not only by the population, but by the media. I have said this to the National ID Programme team. They listened.
and carried on.
I didn't say that. Biometrics. There isn't a single biometric. Certainly for a large population like a nation, there are all sorts of quirks that people have in sufficiently large numbers that there are permanent and temporary problems of finger and iris recognition. Your average bricklayer loses his fingerprints about once every 2 weeks, and it changes sufficiently that the fingerprint recognition won't work. There's enough people who do enough manual work that statistic is horrible. Iris recognition is a lot better, but there are a significant number of people who have a problem with one or other or both. And of course there are groups who do not want to have their face shown on photographs. Now, actual facial recognition has close to 100% enrollment. It's quite good. But in the field, it's not very good at all. In other words, the verification breaks down, even though the enrollment's quite good. And there are personal environment factors, depending upon where the verification is going to take place. If you're in a very well-lit studio, and I don't think I've been in an immigration booth that feels like that, but, you know. So if the false rejection goes up too much, refusal of service, no, you can't come into this country, we don't know who you are, or the service slows down to an unacceptable level, it isn't going to look very pretty. So the biometrics, I'm not trying to say it doesn't have its value and it doesn't have its place, but we must be very careful not to over-egg this bit of technology's contribution to our ability to identify uniquely a given body. I'll come back to one of the subtleties of functionality. The first bullet is pretty obvious that it's, indeed, if you think of what the English word means, identical, it means it's identical. In other words, when you verify, it's identical to what it was at enrollment. If it was wrong at enrollment and it's still the same, then fine, it's identical. You've managed your identity. Doesn't mean have any relationship to other things to do with you as a unique person if you falsified all of that. So plus or minus the biometrics, I can do all sorts of things and still walk around with a re-verifiable identity. So you have to be very careful what it is you're expecting to get out of an identity management service. The second thing you have to be careful of is what other potential functions do you then aim to do with it that you hadn't thought of when you first implemented it. Because if you try to do that over extensively, you run into all sorts of social problems as well as legal problems. And in particular, think of prove rights for entitlement to services. Now, the English here is quite subtle. The identity isn't essential when at the point of service delivery, only at the point of rights enrollment. So for instance, if I'm entitled to social security payments, I will go to a social security office, disclose my identity and a lot of other stuff as well to justify my rights to a payment. But when I go and get the payment, which won't be at the social security office, it may well be at my local post office, I don't necessarily want to give away my identity, my address, or anything else about me. All I have to show is I have rights. And that's a subtle distinction, and I think a very important distinction, in the balance between, and a word I've not uttered yet, identity and privacy. I want control over when I disclose my identity to establish rights, and when I want to maintain privacy over that. And if you talk to the people in the libertarian movements, they get really heated about this particular issue of me having disclosure rights over privacy and identity information. For instance, personal attributes or proof of nationality. When do I have to do that? When is it obligatory to disclose that element of my identity information for certain rights, maybe to do with travel, to do with medical services, or to do with other government provided or any other form of service that might be provided? The other topic I've not touched on very much is the registry information, that is to say, where is all this information stored? In the national system, it's called a registry, and I use that phrase, but it's really where it is stored. How much do you store on the card or the token? How much do you store on the registry? It depends on the data and systems architecture, but it also depends upon your view of what happens when I lose it, do I have to be online to make use of it? And there's some really quite complicated service architecture as well as system architecture issues that you have to understand in order to deliver the functionality and the privacy and the security. And this is a very rapid run through of some of the system and data architecture. I won't dwell too much on this tonight. Is it distributed? What's the availability issue? How do you change the availability? You have to upgrade your system. a very important one, actually, is the number of concurrent users. How many people are going to be registering, verifying, and enrolling at any given time on this system? It could be tens, if not hundreds of thousands. Now, anybody who's involved in the systems end of thinking about this means they've actually got to worry about that big time if you want a few seconds response, which, of course, the people building large cash machine systems do worry about, but they're quite expensive. And indeed, the upgrades are very carefully managed. Am I going to prove my identity and access this through a whole range of different terminals? And some of them are just listed there. It could take some time for a national system to be rolled out. This stuff changes very fast. The architectures we use now, we wouldn't have even dreamed of using the words about 4 years ago. If this takes 7 years to roll out, what's it going to look like at the end compared with what it was at the beginning? Why are we doing a national system? Why aren't we doing a regional system, which we know works quite well in Germany? But it works in Germany for all sorts of other reasons, which are to do with legal systems and constitutional reasons, which are different from how they are in the UK. And systems failures, heaven forbid, you need to re-verify data on occasions, and you certainly need to re-verify data if you move house. 40% of Londoners move house every year. So if your address is one of the bits of critical information in the registry, imagine the update rate on that and how accurate that information is going to be. If I share this information, or if anyone who owns the registry information thinks they're going to share it, what are the protocols by which that happens? Does the citizen or the person who is identified have any control over it? What are the benefits and risks to the citizen as well as to the department, whether it's government or otherwise? Who sets the standards for security? He's probably sitting in the room. But you know, that's a very important issue, not only for the national scheme, but for schemes that have to interoperate with the national scheme. And who audits them, and how often, and is it a target for denial of service attack? Well, it is. And so there's a whole issue of how do I ensure that that isn't going to happen. Who checks the data? It's my data, or is it? I enrolled, it's about me, so I should be able to check this and have the standards. But some of the biographical footprints certainly won't be in English. We're a multicultural society. And are there enough cleared people to carry that out, the enrolment in particular, when the language isn't English? And unfortunately, we have a significant fraction of our population who are illiterate and won't have a written biographical footprint. So how do we manage their identity unless we absolutely minimise the amount of information that's held about them? Which it is alleged we're going to do for the national scheme, but will that work for a slightly more complex scheme that might be used in a commercial environment? So, I've galloped through lots of issues and I hope left lots of open threads. What I see as some of the main conclusions are that the ownership and security information is a huge subject for debate. And there has not been a public debate about it in the context of the national scheme. There's been lots of media attention applied to it, but I don't believe there's been a really well-balanced, totally objective public debate about the subject. Biometrics, I think, have been over-egged. That's not to say they don't have their place and their capability, but the evidence that they are good enough to deliver what is alleged they will deliver, I don't believe to be strong enough. And a lot of the trials that have been done so far would indicate that that is the case. There's, in my view, some less than brilliant statistical analysis and conclusions based on that statistical analysis out there. There are quite a few systems issues that are complex and unresolved. Not to say they're unresolvable, but in order to deliver a trustworthy service, they need resolution fairly quickly. Where are the benefits going to come from? Because the evidence that supports the allegations and assertions for benefits are not really there in terms of the evidence. And in case you thought I was against all this, I'm not. We do have to find a way of identifying people, and we've got to do it a lot better than we currently are. It's just what is being proposed in terms of a national scheme looks as if it has too many loopholes in it. And if commerce starts having to worry about this on a scale that's anywhere near comparable, and some commercial organisations certainly are, for the reasons that James alluded to in terms of insider threats, then we have to come up with some plausible solutions. And I think we need a more holistic view of identity management and the security of it than we've got at the moment. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. As you were speaking, I was thinking that we're speaking very much about a national context, and the international environment, of course, is the one in which anything national will operate, and that just goes to make it even more complex. And I was also thinking that, you know, with our existing systems, we have so much trouble with identity, as you were implying. But I'm a case in point, because my first name is spelled Robin with an I. And in this country, that's a no-no, whereas it's quite common in Canada. So for my Visa card here in this country, they insist that my card name be R. Elizabeth Mansell. But I have a Visa card in Canada where they insist that my name be the name that I'm known by, which is Robin, and they don't have the E. And when I go back and forth, well, you have no idea the numbers of just completely mad situations when somebody has done a check on me. And, you know, this, I'm... No, I'm me. And then when we scale up with all of these kinds of issues that Brian has so provocatively put on the table, I think, you know, it's just very difficult to have that kind of objective discussion. People feel very emotive about all of these kinds of things. And I think because he's been provocative, as I knew he would be, I'm not going to open it up for discussion yet, because what I'd like to do is move on to John Edwards, who is head of international communication practice for Herbert Smith.